Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Holocaust survivors on why so many Jewish organizations are going to be participating in this Sunday's marches in support of Darfur. But first, what a week in Washington. Congressional lawmakers came back after a two-week break and faced $3-a-gallon gas prices, an immigrant boycott that's threatening to shut down U.S. businesses on Monday, and senators who say that the only way to fix the Federal Emergency Management Agency is to scrap it altogether. Well, joining us with more on all of the congressional fireworks this week and a look at the week ahead is frequent Here and Now congressional watcher Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor. Hi, Gail.
Hi, Robin. Good to be with you.
Well, good to hear you. And let's start by talking about what's on everyone's mind, gas prices. Congress has responded with a flurry of proposals. President Bush is calling for Congress to give the Transportation Department the power to increase fuel economy standards. But is any of this talk real, given the political climate?
Oh, it's most certainly real. I think both Democrats and Republicans realize this has rocketed to possibly the most important issue on voters' minds come the fall, which will determine control of the House and the Senate. And so you had the spectacle of dueling press conferences at gas stations all week long, with members being driven in their gas-guzzling SUVs to make an appeal for conservation.
I guess what I mean is any of it doable, given that, for instance, the Senate plan calls for drilling at Anwar, which Democrats hate?
Okay. The Anwar, I think both sides realize, is a non-starter. Now, the gas prices give it a little bit more momentum, but the votes are not there in the Senate, and I think that that will be dropped at some point. But in terms of demonstrating a commitment to easing prices at the tank in whatever way you can, both sides are talking about some kind of rebate, some kind of windfall profits tax. Tax breaks for hybrids is an element that both sides support. I think you'll certainly see finger-wagging hearings at oil executives over issues like driving up the price or exorbitant compensation packages for executives. Everyone is talking about the compensation for Lee Raymond, the ExxonMobil former chief.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you'll certainly see a lot of talk about this. Whether anything will come out of it, you know, at this point in the congressional cycle, everything comes down to already calculations about the fall. It's an issue that Democrats may rather see as an issue than as something concrete. And I think both sides admit that in the short run, there's very little that can be done to change the prices at the tank.
Well, we want to touch on the other contentious issue this week, which was lobbying reform in the House. Republicans almost killed the bill, which would have been an embarrassing way to end the week.
It was a dramatic moment. You know, we were outside the House gallery there voting on the rule on this lobby reform, and it was looking as if that rule was certain to go down. And reporters were already asking questions about the GOP leadership there. It's not Tom DeLay. It's not Newt Gingrich. What does this say about them? And suddenly the Speaker came in with an entourage, and we knew something had happened. In fact, he had gone into a back room with the appropriators, who were holding on jealously to earmarks, which is a big aspect of their power, and basically read them the Riot Act. You know, you are Republicans, and he committed also to including earmark reform for all the other committees, not just theirs. In the end, whether it was arm twisting or a genuine policy consensus on extending the earmark reform, they agreed to vote with it. So the rule passed. Now, there is still a lot of water under this bridge before the vote on Tuesday.
And that'll be voted on next Tuesday, and as you said, talked about quite a bit between now and then. Well, we want to touch on the immigration debate. As we mentioned, many immigrant activist groups planning to stay home from work on Monday and boycott businesses, though the immigrant community is divided on whether this is the best way to move forward. And as this debate's taking place, a Spanish version of the national anthem was released today. It's called Nuestro Himno, or Our Hymn, Our Anthem. Here's a sample. We got it from the website HispanicAd.com. Let's listen for a second, then we'll talk over it.
Sus estrellas, sus trans,
sus estrellas.
Rodaban ayer.
Actually, you know what? I think we should fade that out because I feel uncomfortable talking over a national anthem. But Gail Chadwick, I know we can't really talk over it, but this is an example of how the immigration movement is split itself. Many immigrants are worried that Monday's planned Great American Boycott, in combination with this song, will make mainstream America mad. President Bush has just said today that he feels that this song should be in English, that the American anthem should be in English. How, you know, how testy is this topic going to get in the minute we have?
It's a very serious issue, and I think members of Congress, even those that are pushing for some kind of comprehensive reform and a path to legalization, are concerned about the backlash from Monday. If this looks, if this really does do some damage to the economy and looks militant, disrespectful, I think you'll see some momentum claimed by those on the other side who don't want to see comprehensive reform, just slap up something on the border. That is the heart of the debate, and I think Monday is going to be a very key test of whether or not there is a backlash out there or whether or not this will actually help build momentum for a more comprehensive solution.
Gail Chadwick, a congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from the Capitol. Gail, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
The crisis in Darfur could be reaching a critical point. Peace talks to end the genocide face a Sunday deadline for a settlement. And today, the United Nations Food Agency said it's cutting rations for 3 million people in the region because it doesn't have enough money. Well, Save Darfur rallies on Sunday are expected to attract thousands in Washington and more than a dozen other cities. The attention to Darfur follows Holocaust Remembrance Day, which took place this week, and many Jewish organizations are going to be participating on Sunday. We're about to find out why. We're going to spend a few minutes reflecting on that horrific period in world history with two people who experienced it. Their stories are told in the book, I Refused to Die, Stories of Boston Area Holocaust Survivors and Soldiers Who Liberated the Concentration Camps of World War II. It's by journalist and poet Susie Davidson. We'll hear from her later. Also from Chan Rogers. He's one of the soldiers who helped liberate the concentration camp at Dachau. But first, we turn to Holocaust survivor Roseanne Zerner. Roseanne was just 6 years old. She was born into a well-to-do, educated Lithuanian family. And Roseanne, the borders were closed, and you were herded into the Kovno ghetto in Lithuania, where, amazingly, your parents dug a hole under the barbed wire fence and pushed you out?
I was 6 years old at the time, and so the hole did not have to be too big, but they had to do it, timing the guards, timing the searchlights, timing the dogs that were guarding the premises all the time. And actually, it happened one dark night. They pushed me through it, and it worked. And I ran across the river to freedom.
And as you write, kept running for
years.
Just
kept running and running, yes.
You say you were saved by many, betrayed by many. Who betrayed you?
I was in an orphanage, and the nuns betrayed me, and then the priest saved me. Then I was with rescuers who hid me, and some of their families would betray me. And sometimes I would trust people, and they were not trustworthy. But in the long run, the goodness of those who rescued me were the things that influenced my life more than anything else, because the fact that they would put their own lives at risk just to save me attest to the human nature possibilities.
Do you remember this? Do you remember being a six-year-old running through the woods? Do you remember the feeling of, you know, your life turned upside down?
Absolutely. I remember it in my cells, and I also went back to reconnect with that part of my life that had blocked out most of my adult life. Not until 2000 was I able to face all this because it was too painful for me.
Roseanne Zerner, I know that you have been speaking now after years of not talking at all about, and by the way, not talking even to your family, not talking to kids, not talking about it at all?
Well, my family didn't talk to me about it much. Actually, they also suppressed the whole Holocaust experience until we gave my father a computer for his 80th birthday and he started writing. And then it was like an avalanche. It was a liberating as well as a healing experience for all of us.
Mm. Roseanne Zerner, who escaped from death camps in Lithuania and survived the Holocaust. We're also joined by Chan Rogers. He was in the Army regiment that liberated the Dachau concentration camp on April 29th, 1945. Several camps had fallen by the time, you know, the troops reached Dachau, and the Germans knew. They had been moving prisoners around, and they kept thinking that they could keep this final camp intact, so they had tried to send prisoners from other camps there. What did you find at Dachau?
One of these trains had arrived in Dachau the day before with 2,300 bodies, very grotesquely laid out in these cars of this train. It was a terrible sight and caused a number of the men just to go berserk to take retribution.
On the German SS soldiers?
On the German guards. And it wasn't just one train. There were eight trains that were loaded at Buchenwald. I call it the most egregious act of the entire Holocaust. Here it was, Germany was on their knees. They couldn't move in their equipment and men around because of the interdiction of the railroads, but yet they loaded up eight trains of 30,000 people, inmates, and really murdered them.
Rosine, you're having a hard time hearing this.
Well, 40 of my relatives perished in the Holocaust. I shouldn't say perished, were murdered in the Holocaust. Some tortured, like my grandfather, within the first week of invasion. My grandmother was shot in a bread line when she forgot to wear her yellow star because she was elderly. And when I hear about the cruelty and the torture that came, realized that this was not just mass killings, this was brutality.
Chan, how old were you?
I just finished high school when I went into the service in 1943 and then ended up going overseas. The night we went online, it snowed 30 inches. I had never seen snow as I was raised in Florida, but I slept in it or lived in it for a week there in eastern France before we went into the attack mode to drive toward the Rhine.
My uncle also liberated camps, and I called him on the 50th anniversary of D-Day. Remember, it was the big deal, and everybody was over there. And he started crying, and he said, you know, in 50 years, no one has ever asked me about this. And I'm wondering, what about you?
Very much the same. I didn't really start thinking about what had happened in World War II until 40 years or so later.
Why is that? Why is that? Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't know. We were all just busy raising children and our careers and other activities and didn't think of dwelling on the past, so to speak. But maybe it's because you move into a retirement mode that you tend to dwell on these things. And now that we've uncovered some of these problems, I think it's very important that we document this and leave a legacy so that people and generations in the future will be able to guard against these kinds of things ever happening.
Chan Rogers, one of the American soldiers who liberated the Dachau death camp in 1945. We also are speaking with Rosine Zerner. As a six-year-old, she escaped from the Kovno ghetto in Lithuania. Their stories are collected in Susie Davidson's book, I Refused to Die, Stories of Boston Area Holocaust Survivors and Soldiers Who Liberated the Concentration Camps of World War II. How their experience relates to genocide today. We'll hear about that when we come back. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Thousands of Jewish groups have organized and will take part in Save Darfur rallies across the country. The Jewish groups include the United Jewish Communities, the Jewish Community Relation Council, and the Jewish Council for Public Affairs. It would seem obvious that Jews would lead the protest against genocides, as they have since World War II. We've been speaking with Holocaust survivor Rosine Zerner and with Chan Rogers. He was one of the American soldiers who helped liberate the concentration camp in Dachau. Their stories are featured in a book by Susie Davidson. It's called I Refused to Die, Stories of Boston Area Holocaust Survivors and Soldiers Who Liberated the Concentration Camps of World War II. We're going to hear from author Susie in a moment. But Rosine, to you first, because while you are horrified by Darfur and were horrified by Rwanda before that, you wanted to make a distinction that's important to you. Go ahead.
the tragedy in Darfur and in Rwanda and even the Congo that nobody speaks about is they're horrible. And the genocide in Armenia were horrible tragedies, and the Jews are always in the forefront in protesting them. But the Holocaust is different. This is a time when Jews were sought out in all countries, not just one, and no matter who they were murdered. So it differentiates it from the genocides in general. So in one way, it has to be preserved as a lesson for history, as a symbol for all the other genocides, rather than being in the same soup, so to speak.
But I understand you say, Rosianne, that it should be a lesson. But Chan, do you find you still find people who haven't heard about this?
I haven't heard about it, but not even sure that it happened, because there are deniers who provide some seeming evidence that it didn't.
I have had people tell me to my face that the Holocaust didn't happen, even after I tell them I was there. There is a total parallel society emerging, and it needs to be educated. It needs to be... the rest of us need to be vigilant and aware that this is actually happening, because it's just one way that the Jews can be persecuted again.
Yes, I'd like to point out the recent announcement by the president of Iran that the Holocaust didn't exist. He tells the entire Muslim world this, and they all believe him. We may not, the Christian world may not, but this is dangerous for this to come out in that kind of context. And these are the kind of things we have to be guarding against, and because somebody will pick it up that it may not have happened.
Chan, when you hear of news stories of genocide in Darfur, of whole villages moving to get away from the Janjaweed, for instance, you know, what are you picturing in your head?
Well, to me, it's more of the same in terms of what happened during World War II, but to a more civilized group, and it's now happening in Africa and several places. And these things in some way have to be stopped. We seem to be less inclined to be interested because they're in a faraway place. But the things that the world has to understand, and this country has come into its position as a leader in the world and is going to have to take some responsibility to stop some of these things in around the world, if that's what our legacy is.
Susie Davidson, it occurs to me that we're sitting here with two beautiful individuals, but the survivors of the Holocaust are not going to be around, you know, in the next 10, 20 years. I mean, their voices are going to be stilled.
Well, I mean, 6 million voices are stilled as well. And yet, by contributing to pay tribute to these people, the ones who are alive now, as well as the ones who perished, that is the best way I feel that we can make some good out of what happened to them and to honor them. My approach with the book was never to condemn the Nazis, because I felt that that was kind of futile. We all know what they are. We all know what they did. Rather, I chose to honor the victims, honor the people who lived through it and did something with their lives. The people in the book are educators, social workers, engineers. Warren Priest, a liberating soldier, is still running camps for inner-city youth in the White Mountains because he saw a child killed. These people are all examples of what you can do with the worst. And I hope that if people read their stories, they can also be inspired to make something of the darkest days.
I guess, Rosianne and Chan, do you feel that need to, you know, do you feel that compulsion to speak as much as you can?
We have a world that doesn't seem to learn from history, and it is there in front of their eyes with the Holocaust, and it has an opportunity for redemption. And this is the time that we can do something as survivors to make it happen by speaking out, by making people realize that there is another way, that there is hope for humanity rather than on the suicidal path that we've engaged in.
And Chan, you seemed, you know, to take it personally when you talked about people trying to deny what you saw. Yes. Do you feel that this is your job now?
Yes, I feel that they have to be countered. That this cannot be allowed to continue in terms of denying. It did exist. As I said, this manifestation of civilized people loading 30,000 people into 8 trains is just unbelievably egregious. And for people to deny today that it ever happened is unacceptable. And for people like myself who had the direct experience, I feel I'm obligated, morally obligated, to speak out and preserve the legacy of the fact that these things did happen and should not be allowed to happen again and be recognized before they happen.
Chan Rogers, he helped liberate the concentration camp at Dachau. We also spoke with Roseanne Zerner. Her parents helped her escape from the Kovno ghetto in Lithuania when she was just 6. Their stories and others are told in Susie Davidson's book, I Refused to Die, Stories of Boston Area Holocaust Survivors and Soldiers Who Liberated the Concentration Camps of World War II. And again, there are massive marches to save Darfur scheduled for this Sunday. And this note, next week on Here and Now, the Great American Boycott. That's scheduled for Monday. We'll be checking in on the immigrant protests across the U.S., touch in with protesters south of the border who have threatened to boycott American businesses there as well. That's all next week. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston. National Atomic Energy Agency said today that Iran had enriched uranium in defiance of the UN Security Council. This sets the stage for a Security Council resolution requiring Iran to suspend its nuclear activities or face sanctions and possible military action. President Bush said earlier today that the world is united and concerned about Iran's suspected desire to build a nuclear weapon, but also earlier today, Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said the Iranian nation won't give a damn about any such resolution. Well, while the U.S. and Iran seemed headed for confrontation, two scholars, both now at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, have proposed a possible compromise between Iran and the U.S., and it comes from their unique perspectives. Matthew Bunn worked on nuclear issues for the Clinton administration, and Abbas Malachi served as deputy foreign minister in Iran. And Abbas, I want to start with you. How do you explain Iran's president's continued defiance of the international community when it comes to his nuclear energy program? Do you think he wants to build a bomb?
Really, I think this is rhetoric. I think Iranian president wants to use Iranian proudness in this issue.
You think he's just stirring up the masses with this issue?
Yes, I think it is not all of Iran. Iran has huge oil and gas, universities, society is very active. Therefore, I don't know why both sides, I want to say outside of Iran and Iran's government, wants to concentrate only and focus only to this issue.
Well, as you know, Abbas, many people feel that it's because he wants to ultimately build a weapon to perhaps wipe out Israel. What do you think?
Really, Iran is not in the edge of the access to the nuclear weapon technology. It's only 3.5 uranium enrichment facilities. As you know, and all of our audiences, they know it needs more than 90%.
Well, Matthew Bunn, first of all, before we get to your proposal, do you agree? Do you think this is just rhetoric?
I think it's my guess, and Abbas knows much more about Iran than I do, of course, that President Ahmadinejad is intentionally creating more of a crisis than there needs to be in order to create a rallying around effect to boost support for the regime within Iran.
Well, regardless, you both have been concerned enough about that rhetoric to come up with this proposal. And I want to talk about your plan. It builds on a proposal that was made by Russia several weeks ago that would have Moscow build a new uranium enrichment facility in Russia and provide fuel to Iran for domestic peaceful use. Now, when Russia floated the idea, President Bush was supportive, but the Iranians balked. Matthew, let's start with you. Tell us the ideas that you propose that you say will make this plan more palatable to the Iranians this time around.
What we propose is that Iran would accept the arrangement where enrichment would take place in Russia. But in addition to that, there would be a consortium of the major enrichment suppliers that would offer a guarantee to Iran that if anything happened with the Russian supply, they would step in and supply.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. You talk about things like an IAEA-controlled fuel bank or a UN-controlled
exactly.
fuel bank.
That's right. And ultimately, the most reliable guarantee would be there would be a stockpile of fuel that was physically in Iran so that if there were an interruption of all these different layers of guarantees, Iran would have fuel that it could put in its reactors.
Well, let me stop you right there, Matthew Bunn, because I'm wondering, and I'll bring in Abbas here, because Abbas, as you all know, studying as you are at the Kennedy School here in Cambridge, that many Americans hear the phrase stockpile in Iran and they immediately get nervous. Why would Americans want to see a stockpile of enriched uranium in Iran? That sounds like, you know, if radicals got a hold of that, it could be very dangerous.
Really, Iran is not only president, and the Iranian political decision-making is very complicated, and there are a lot of checkpoints. Iran understands in international arena, it must be rational if they want to be survived. Therefore, I think the stockpile of uranium in Iran with this low enrichment, 3.5 or something like that, it is not any danger for any other countries.
It's an important point that it would be only low-enriched uranium. It would not be useful for nuclear weapons. Without further enrichment, it would be under international safeguards. And because Iran is going to have a operating nuclear reactor at Bushehr, in any case, it will be receiving large supplies of low-enriched uranium from abroad, even under the proposal that President Bush and Secretary Rice have endorsed. Yes.
Well, so this would address the fears of Iran that their supply would might be cut off. But I want to address another key part of your compromise, which you mentioned, Matthew, which is a pledge by the U.S. promising not to attack Iran. Now, the president of Iran has made comments threatening to strike at U.S. interests and has threatened to wipe Israel off the map. Do you really think a pledge from the U.S. is going to cause the president to abandon, you know, these goals?
Well, the pledge that we talk about is a reciprocal pledge. That is, it would be the United States would pledge and the other major powers would pledge not to attack Iran or attempt to overthrow its government as long as Iran complied with the nuclear agreement and did not commit or sponsor aggression.
I want to bring Abbas in because I'm wondering— there are a lot of people who think that Washington is already planning to attack Iran.
You know, it is up to American people to decide about their national interest. It is not pro even U.S. national interest, and it is totally against Iranian national interest as a country, as a nation with 7,000 years civilization. But at the same time, it's up to you and other Americans to decide to this case.
I think it's important when you think about the potential risks of a proposal like ours to think hard about the potential risks of the alternatives, including the danger of military strikes. I believe that military strikes would deeply damage U.S. national security interests. They would certainly drive the oil price up to levels that have never before been seen. There are many things Iran could do in response to U.S. military strikes that would deeply damage our interests, and particularly given our situation in Iraq. It's my belief that this is drifting dangerously toward military confrontation, and that's why Abbas and I sought to work together to see if we could come up with a compromise proposal that would serve both sides' national interests and that both Iranians and Americans, at least outside their respective governments, could both sign their names to.
That's Matthew Bunn. He worked in the Clinton administration. And we've also been speaking with Abbas Maleki. He served as deputy foreign minister in Iran. But they're both now at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and they've both crafted what they call a possible compromise between Iran and the U.S. And I want to thank you both for telling us about it.
Thank you for having us here.
Thank you.
And by the way, if you'd like to read their paper, just go to our website, here-now.org. And don't go away. Still to come today, an opera singer inspired by a silly wabbit. You're listening to Here and Now. It appeared at the bookstores on April 4th, got some favorable reviews, and its 19-year-old author, an undergrad at Harvard, got plenty of attention for her $500,000 two-book advance. But now the publisher of the novel, How Opal Mehta Got Kissed, Got Wild, and Got a Life, says it's pulling the book from store shelves and that retailers have been asked to return unsold copies after a week of headlines charging that the author, Kaiva Viswanathan, lifted material from two books by author Megan McCaffrey. Well, joining us now is Jeffrey Pullum, professor of linguistics at the University of California at Santa Cruz, although he's on leave, and he joins us from his office at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard. Professor Pullum, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
And this is certainly a huge deal in the book world, but as a linguist, you're also taking it very seriously. Earlier this week, Ms. Viswanathan said on the Today Show that she was surprised and upset to learn that there are similarities between passages in her books and the books by Megan McCafferty. She says she read and loved McCafferty's books when she was in high school and must have internalized them. As a linguist, you say what?
I have to admit I'm inclined not to believe that. The probabilities are just too low. This novel has got passages as long as 14 words straight copied from another novel. And if you look at the 14-word passage, that's the longest, it's really closer to 21 in that the following passage has just switched smart or pretty to pretty or smart, or the other way around, I forget which. And the part before that has just switched one noun for another. It's really more like 20, 21 words in a row that are straight out of an earlier novel.
Well, you write that even the phrase that is exactly the 14 words from McCafferty's novel, you write on the language log online that if text was being composed at random, the probability that you'll find the next 14 words match some previously designated sequence of 14 words is very roughly in the region of 1 in 10 to the 28th.
Yes, that's right. These numbers are absurdly small probabilities. Just to double-check before I came on this program, I had a look at a random text of no importance, an email from my accountant, and took the second paragraph and the first few words and started looking whether those words had occurred on Google. For the first two words, 10 million hits. For the first three words, 182. But for the first four words of the perfectly ordinary thing my accountant said to me, no hits at all. So then I was shocked at that, and I tried the next paragraph. The first two words, 972 hits. For the first three words, zero. Nobody had ever put those three words together on Google, on the whole web, that is, that Google could find at all. The probability of your really overlapping with what somebody else said is so low that when you do remember whole sentences, you remember them very clearly. I go back to teach at a university where, I'm sorry to report, undergraduates do plagiarize, and they plagiarize outrageously.
You consider what this author did plagiarism, but I just want to read you one of the responses on the language log to your posting. Bill Poser writes as well, and he says that remembering phrases 14 words or less is entirely within human memory. He disagrees with you. He says many people remember whole phrases of songs, and so he writes, it seems likely that a person with a strong literary orientation should have little snatches of other people's words floating around in her head.
It's numerous passages, including vivid anecdotes, and then not just odd cliches or little turns of phrase, but whole sequences of words describing a particular event with random details, like the word brainy being italicized in both the book that she copied from and her own novel. This is not something that could be called an affectionate allusion to language that you're supposed to recognize. And I don't believe it's within the bounds of probability that it could all have been just from unconscious memories of a favorite book. It is a very worrying feature of our culture, and I can't treat it lightly.
Thank you, Professor Jeffrey Pullum of UC Santa Cruz. And by the way, to read more of that linguistic debate online, go to our website, here-now.org. More ahead here and now. Is the budding opera star rehearsing here for the Opera Boston production of Lucrezia Borgia, the same person invited in 2004 to sing at Placido Domingo's birthday party at the White House. Barbara Quintiliani was born into a working-class family in the then shipbuilding town of Quincy, Massachusetts, and she's worked her way up. She's now playing the cunning title character in Opera Boston's production of Donizetti's Lucrezia Borgia, and it's an incredible story as to how she got there. Barbara Quintiliani, welcome.
Thank you.
And let's tell people a little bit about Lucrezia Borgia. Am I saying that correctly?
Yes.
Because it's considered, you know, a real plum role, a proving ground for sopranos. Give us the short version.
This role is about the most villainous woman in Italian history, we could say. She's renowned for having poisoned at least three husbands, and her father was actually the Pope.
So a lot of intrigue,
a lot of drama. In the opera, she's chasing down her long-lost son, and she tells him that his mother is watching over him from afar, and the angels are praying for him, and that there is someone that cares very deeply about him in a wonderful duet. She tries to hide the fact that she has this son from her husband, and in the end, you know, everything she touches turns to dust. Mm. She manages to poison at least six people before the end of the opera.
Oh, boy.
So.
And she herself, as we said, the illegitimate daughter of the Pope. So
that's correct.
It's got it all.
It's everything.
I want you to listen to what Richard Dyer of the Boston Globe here in Boston says about a past performance of yours. From a broad facial structure that recalls that of Joan Sutherland emerges a major voice, large and glamorous across a wide range extending at least to high D, and she's also a natural actress, not subtle but genuine. A long way from the girl in school in Virginia at the time. As you write, you were 16 years old and just steps away from being a pregnant mother on welfare.
We just had a really bad neighborhood. The drugs were there, the bad things were there, and it was, you know, very challenging for a young person to stay away from all of that. Luckily, I was very much in love with being in school, and I loved to read and study, so that helped me a lot, you know.
And so we come to this choral audition.
Yes, I had to take a course credit to graduate. You need a fine art credit.
Did you think you could sing?
Were
you...
No. And I said that to the guidance counselor. I said, well, I don't sing, you know. And she said, oh, chorus is easy. Anybody can do chorus.
Do I understand that you sort of thought, well, I'll just imitate sopranos I'd heard on cartoons or something?
We were doing a all-city chorus. They were looking for the soprano soloist, and I had thought that being in there was a total waste of my time, so I was cutting up and passing notes with the girlfriends in the back. And the teacher finally said, look, you know, you got to show me you can learn something in this class. So he gave me a tape of someone singing this soprano solo, and he says, just mimic what you hear like it's a song on the radio. Divine inspiration hit. My brother was watching cartoons, and there was this What's Opera Doc Bugs Bunny cartoon. And that's what the music sounded like to me. There's this woman with this very high voice and the vibrato and so.
Well, hold on a second. First of all, let's remind ourselves what, for those who haven't heard the What's Opera Doc, let's hear a little bit of that.
Kill the wabbit, kill the wabbit, kill the wabbit.
Kill the wabbit.
Yo-ho-to, 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 yo-ho!
Oh, mighty warrior of great fighting stock. Might I inquire to ask him, what's up, Doc?
And I thought it was hilarious. So I thought, okay, fine, he's going to make me do this. I'm going to make the whole class laugh and just imitate this thing. And I got there and I sang and nobody laughed. And at the end, the choir director says, oh, Barbara, he's like, I had no idea you could really sing.
Well, so you were discovered off this audition, but it took a long time. I mean, you ended up at the New England Conservatory here in Boston, sewing buttons on costumes rather than wearing them. You held down three jobs. You cleaned bathrooms. Why? You know, this incredible voice now. What was missing? What was the disconnect between you actually being on the stage and trying to get
there? Well, it's time and training. I mean, the thing is about being an opera singer is it takes years to learn that craft. Singers, their voice aren't completely mature until they're in their middle to late 30s. That's when the voice really solidifies and comes into its own, and you begin singing the repertoire you were meant to sing.
Well, and you are singing it, as we said, with the Boston Opera currently.
Yes.
What does that feel like now, in the middle of the stage, in the middle of the spotlight?
It's exhilarating. I mean, we all we do this because for many reasons, but I mean, one of them is it's a wonderful, wonderful ride. I mean, the adrenaline, the audience, the feeling of walking on a tightrope, because here you are, you know, screaming over 50 people in an orchestra pit, and you're depending on two small pieces of, you know, gristle in your throat to do it with. So it's a wonderful, exciting, exhilarating feeling. And I'm never happier or never more myself than when I'm on the stage.
Well, we want to hear more of the voice of Barbara Quintiliani. Let's hear from three poems of Fiona MacLeod, The Rose of the Night.
Save the seas, thunderous might, deep in the sea.
You're not the first to hit the opera stage to have come from humbler beginnings than, you know, the audience that regularly attends opera. But I'm wondering if, you know, ever now you feel, gee, I don't belong here. I didn't grow up studying opera. I discovered it late in life.
Oh, absolutely.
You do?
Absolutely. When I was in the Young Artists Program in Washington, D.C., part of our job is going to the parties and to be with the donors to the opera. And there were many times I was sitting at a table with people thinking, how did I get here? You know, and I don't know what to say. And my favorite memory is of being at the opening night dinner of Idomeneo. And I was sitting at the table with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, one of the justices. And that was... That was awesome. You know, just like look across, you know, next to me, and there she is, and she just wants to talk about Don Giovanni, you know. So it's really great.
Barbara Quintiliani, soprano, currently in the title role in Boston Opera's Lucrezia Borgia. For more about that performance, visit our website, here-now.org. Barbara, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Listen, Tara, they're singing your swan song. Here and Now producer Tara Murphy is moving on to a new venture. Tara, we wish you well. In addition to leaving your sweater, could you please leave behind some of your smarts and your sense of style? I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and the